Hey there, listeners. Before we begin, I wanted to let you know that we have another live show in the works. We're going to be recording a live podcast in Detroit on August 1st. The debates, of course, are in Detroit the previous 2 days, so we'll be reacting to those debates in a live show on August 1st in downtown Detroit. Head to 538.com/live for more information and tickets. All right, here we go.
Chris Hemsworth. I'm not gay, but... jeez, that guy.
I mean,
for that guy, I'd get pretty fluid.
Oh boy, that was something.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Vice President Joe Biden's lead in the Democratic primary polls has shrunk to about 11 points, according to our friends at Real Clear Politics. That's the smallest lead he's had since he announced his candidacy at the end of April. He also released his fundraising numbers for the second quarter of the year, showing that he raised less than Mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, who has announced the biggest haul of the quarter so far. So today we're going to debate whether we should still consider Joe Biden the frontrunner. I understand that that's a little bit of a provocative question, considering that he is still objectively leading in the polls, but we'll see what everyone has to say. And by everyone, I mean senior politics writer Clay Malone. How's it going?
It's going well, Galen.
Managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
And also joining us from D.C. is senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Fabulous. And Nate Silver is out today. He is still playing poker in Vegas. Who knows?
Man,
if he'll
I
ever
wish
return.
I could take just a mulligan from work and be like, I'm playing poker. Can't come in.
I mean, try it. Let's see what happens. Hopefully, at least he'll buy us lunch with all those winnings when he returns.
Do you know what? This is a test to see if he actually listens to this podcast.
Yeah. Okay, wait. We should ask him to do something if he listens to the podcast.
Nate, I've hidden something in your office and it will only appear at the worst possible time.
Now,
come
Nate,
by my desk if you want to know where and what it is.
If you hear this, Nate.
Claire took a shit in your office, Nate.
Wow.
That's your cold open.
That was something.
If you hear this, Nate, slack the group with the word little piggy.
Okay.
That's so
creative
weird.
And weird.
Thing. Something he wouldn't do just by happenstance.
Oink, oink.
Yeah. All right. Also today, representative from Michigan, founding member of the Freedom Caucus, and frequent Trump critic Justin Amash announced his independence on July 4th. That is, he wrote in an op-ed in the Washington Post that he's leaving the Republican Party to become an independent, citing partisan politics as a, quote, existential threat to American principles and institutions. So we're going to discuss whether his defection says anything about the broader political climate, and we'll evaluate the state of the Never Trump movement in general. We'll get to all of that later in the show, but let's begin with Joe Biden. So first off, I want everyone to kind of lay out their positions before we delve deeper into the debate. So Claire, let's start with you. Is Biden still the front runner?
I would say, yes, Biden is still the front runner, but it's a soft lead. The polls don't tell us anything other than that, but I'd say the race is a lot more fluid.
All right, Micah?
I'm going to say no. Not in a real meaningful way.
Ooh, okay. And in like two sentences, why is he not the front runner?
I think we learned that one, much of his support was sort of soft support. And two, his level of support in the polls has gone down. It hasn't gone down a huge amount, but he has kind of crossed a critical threshold, at least historically, from a polling support where you sort of have at least about a 50-50 shot to win the nomination to there's an inflection point where you become an underdog relative to the field. And I think now he's clearly an underdog relative to the field.
So historically, somebody with an 11-point lead over the next person in the pack, for example, doesn't go on to win the nomination the majority of the time or even half of the time.
So like historically, this is all based on some analysis Nate has done, but like historically, a well-known candidate polling in, let's say, the mid-30s to high-30s has anywhere from a 50 to 75% chance of winning the nomination.
Okay.
A candidate polling in the, let's say, 20 to 30s has anywhere from like a 10% chance to like 45% chance.
Man, Micah's short answer was pretty
He asked a follow-up question.
Yeah, although, to be fair, I mean, he came out with a pretty bold position, so I couldn't just let him get away with calling Biden not the front-runner.
Well, I thought we were going to go around and then come back.
All right, Perry, what do you have for us? Is Joe Biden still the front-runner?
I think unequivocally, yes.
All right, another strong
position.
Way to
position. Go, Perry. Way to keep that short.
Exactly. Why?
One is just the obvious. He leads the national polls. Also, he leads the polls in the early states. Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina. He leads all the early polls, and early state polls do matter. And second, if you look at the polls, even the polls that show a closer race, when you ask Democrats, who do you view as most likely to beat Trump, Biden is like gets half, you know, 50% or something like that. He's like the electability is a big issue in this primary. Maybe people forgot about it for a minute, but I think it's going to come back and be a huge issue throughout. I think he's got a big advantage on electability. I think that's an enduring factor in this primary.
What we're saying, Micah, is that you're being seduced by the cresting wave of the news cycle.
I think that there's certainly a danger in that. And I do think it's good news for Biden that he seems to have dropped. So I saw one average that had him basically going from 30% in an average of polls to 25% in an average of polls. That's a 5-point drop. That's certainly better than a 10-point drop or a 15-point drop, which some polls had. But look, it's not just that his polling has dropped. I think it's why it's dropped and it's how it's dropped. You know, I think we saw in those debates a Biden that didn't seem all that electable.
Yeah. So what I'll say, since I didn't get to give my long answer, is that I think that what we're seeing, like my constant refrain, which I should probably get printed on a t-shirt, is it's probably too early. The debate obviously had an effect for Biden. And I think that his campaign has been doing some cleanup work afterwards. You saw him over the weekend basically apologize for the segregationist comments, 2 weeks after the fact? I think that had a lot to do with the fact that he got pummeled in the debate and it didn't go well. But I think that we've seen, okay, since January, which is basically when this presidential campaign kicked off, so we're 7 months into this, we've seen so many like story flavors of the month. And I'm not saying that this is a flavor of the month thing. I think this is like a fundamental thing about Biden's campaign that is a weakness. But I'm not prepared to say that he's not the front runner because I think it has to play out in real life for a few weeks to see what that's like. So I'm interested in the end of August when that second debate rolls around and he gets on the stage likely more prepared than he was for the first debate. I'm kind of curious to see what the polling on Biden is, who's maybe cornering black support if it's sort of wedged away from Biden more and more. But I just feel like it's too early for us to say. I think, again, to go back to his lead is softened, but I think he's still the leader.
So, Micah, to your point about him appearing on stage as not necessarily electable, that polling that Perry referred to as half of Democratic primary voters saying that they saw him as the most electable, I think it was from an ABC Washington Post poll that showed that 45% of Democratic primary voters after the debate, so after all of that went down, still thought of him as the most likely to win in a general election. The next person in line was Bernie Sanders with only 18% saying that he was the most likely.
That 45% of Democrats say Biden is the most electable, even post-debate, I just think those are soft numbers. I think that's people think of white men as more electable. I think once people see, and you already start to see some of this, once people see Harris and Warren and these other candidates looking better than Biden on stage, and two, like once actually some of these other candidates win some states, I think those electability numbers will change.
Here's a question. Do you think if Biden, Warren, Harris, and Sanders are all on the same stage, how do you think that affects Biden?
I don't think that Biden's presentation to voters is actually all that dependent on who's on stage with him.
I mean, I'm really interested to see Biden and Warren on stage together, given their history. Warren sort of now famously, or only famously, and if you're obsessed with this shit, like called Biden out for his, you know, she wanted a certain kind of bankruptcy bill way back in the early 2000s, and Biden was against it. And she said, you know, Joe Biden says he's pro-woman, but he's, you know, He's really screwing women over. So she's been pretty harsh for like a long time about Joe Biden in particular. And I'm kind of curious to see whether or not she goes after him like that on stage and that has an effect, or if, again, to go back to the double bind that women find themselves in the presidential race, if that comes off as too attacky.
Well, let me sort of, why am I going so anti-Biden? I went into this campaign thinking that Biden's record would be out of step with the energy in the Democratic Party, but that Biden himself and his campaign wouldn't feel that out of step. This is kind of what happened with Clinton in 2016, where, sure, there was a lot of energy on the left, but Clinton was really liberal herself and ran a liberal, you know, on a liberal platform. I've been really surprised by, one, the extent to which Biden, even contemporary comments, like Biden on the trail, has felt out of step with not only where the energy is in the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party writ large.
Like, I mean, I guess I know what you're saying, but it's also like not all voters are into the new ideas that are being put forth in the Democratic Party. A lot of them are, but Biden is, you know, he's carving out his own moderate lane, and that's, and he figures he's got like an unobstructed view of that.
Yeah, Perry, do you see him as out of step with voters, or maybe just out of step with the people who are running for president in 2020?
First of all, I think he used the phrase gangbanger the other day. There are just moments where he's out of step with how everyone talks. He was not particularly good in the debate. He doesn't have a lot of interesting policy ideas either. But I don't see this as about Joe Biden. I don't see his candidacy as... Joe Biden was not known as a particularly centrist person before this campaign. I think his campaign has basically been like, oh, there's an opening in the center, let's take it. And that makes sense, but I don't think he's ideologically set in the center in that way. But I think his big advantage is that not the debates or anything else, but that Joe Biden is a man who is not a socialist. And that is all that's what his campaign is about. He can't say every day, I'm a man who's not a socialist, but that is what his voters are looking for. I think his entire candidacy is about only I can win. I don't necessarily agree with this view that women can't win, but enough Democratic voters I talk to believe it, to where I'm sure Joe Biden's staff is fully aware of this. So I think he's kind of running out the clock. I'm not surprised he's doing poorly at things. Did anybody watch the 2008 campaign and think he was good at I didn't think he was good at debates at the beginning of this process. I'm not surprised Harris and Warren are better than him at debates. That's what I expected on some level. But I still think as long as his main competition is two women and a socialist, he's going to get a lot of electability voters.
But Perry, see, I'm not surprised by that either, but I am surprised by that first point you made, which is Biden, this kind of run out the clock strategy. The Biden campaign has mostly been kind of reactive so far. That is surprising to me, and is all well and good if you're pulling at, you know, 35% or 40% or 45%, but not if you're pulling at like 25% or 20%. I don't think that works.
I think, and I just make a counterpoint of sorts, the coalition that Biden has, even if it's like not strong, it's moderates, it's white people without college degrees, it's African-Americans, it's people over 45. I like that coalition if I'm Biden, in part because the other candidates, except for the black part, really aren't competing for it very much. And it's a coalition of people who are not probably updating their Twitter page every second. And like on top of it, I like his coalition. It's multiracial because I think Pete's got the problem of like not crossing into outside of white people yet. So I like Biden's coalition. That's why I think he's a little stronger than we think, is the people who may, I don't want to be disparaging, the people who like him may not be following every twist and turn of the campaign and maybe don't watch the debates. And I think that might help him.
What do you make, Perry, of Biden's fundraising, right? Because if he's going to take the strategy of I'm the moderate, I'm the institutionalist, I am the heir to Obama's legacy, why isn't he raking in big money across the Democratic spectrum?
I'll be honest, I was surprised by it. Like, Biden's campaign basically, you know, they didn't announce they were running until, you know, further along in the cycle, but Biden had been planning to run for, you know, since February, I think. They had time to build a lot of fundraising momentum. They had time to set everything up. So I thought they'd have a big number, much bigger than Pete Buttigieg, obviously, and they didn't. So that surprised me. And I guess I would say two things about it. The first thing is the obvious is it's not great. It suggests that, I think we know this, that a fair amount of the donors who were behind Obama and Clinton are with Mayor Pete and Harris in particular. Like, so Biden has not cornered the Obama donors the way I thought he would. So I think that was surprising. I would emphasize, though, too, is that Biden's numbers with black voters are really high right now. We know that, and we know from a lot of studies that black voters don't tend to donate as much money as white voters do. So I do think that number, a candidate who has a fair amount of black support can sort of outdo their fundraising versus Pete's fundraising is really great. His black support is really low. And I'd rather have decent fundraising and great black support than great fundraising and no black support.
And just to clarify what those numbers are, these are all self-reported so far. The filing deadline is next Monday. But Buttigieg raised $24.8 million. Biden raised $21.5 million. Sanders, $18 million. Harris, nearly $12 million. As you can see, he's second to Buttigieg and still ahead of people like Sanders who are, you know, raising from lots and lots of donors, although small numbers. I mean, what do you guys make of the fundraising numbers so far?
Well, they're not good for Biden. But I should also note, like, Buttigieg has raised a lot of money, but he's not polling great. I mean, he's polled better in the race. So that's also kind of like, okay, Buttigieg has been working the fundraising circuit super hard. Maybe Biden hasn't been as much. I don't know. Maybe
he has been too.
Maybe Buttigieg is exciting people because he's a new face and people are sort of bored with Biden. I don't know. But I'll just say that, like, Buttigieg hasn't risen in the polls commensurate with the rise he's seen in fundraising. So
no,
that's worth something.
Yeah. No, in fact, his polls have deteriorated a bit of late.
Right.
Like that surge, you know, he was up to high single, like 8 or 9, but now he's down to 5 points, basically. But look, like, let's go through all these data points, okay? So in the Real Clear Politics average, Biden has 26% of the vote, to Harris at 15%, Sanders 14%, Warren 14%. So Biden has about an 11-point lead. Endorsements, in our endorsement tracker, Biden has 102 endorsement points, followed by Harris at 78, Booker at 57. Basically, the takeaway there is, like, almost all potential endorsers have not endorsed anyone yet. Fundraising numbers, as we just talked through, those look bad for Biden now. Not bad, but like a little disappointing.
Not stellar.
And so I think, to me, what has changed here is we have gone from a blank slate campaign where almost everything was theoretical except for Biden. Most people knew who Biden was. Most of the other candidates didn't have high name recognition. So now we're at a point where everything is sort of much more real. Like, the analogy I would make is like the first quarter of a basketball game between two teams who have never played each other before. So while sure there's so much time to go and like Biden could absolutely still win the nomination, don't get me wrong, that would not surprise me at all. But I'm willing to put a little more weight on what we've learned so far, because it's the first quarter of a game between teams we've never seen play each other. And so it's sort of like much better information than we had 6 months ago. And I think looking at what we have now, the takeaway is definitely Biden is an underdog relative to the field. But our default here is always default to the polls. But if I were a betting person, I think I'd probably bet on Harris now or Warren now over Biden.
I was just going to ask, okay, if Biden isn't the front runner, who is? Can you land on a particular person and make an argument based in data that we're seeing today?
Well, so, okay, just to clarify our terms, if I came in here and made the argument, Biden is not the front runner because he's an underdog relative to the field, you guys would all yell at me, right? Because, of course, he's an underdog relative to the field.
No, I think it's a relevant point. I think 2 months ago I would have said Biden... When Biden was in the 40s, I would have said he was a favorite over the field. I don't think that anymore. That has changed now for me, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a big difference.
But you could still be a front runner and not the favorite over the field.
Yes, totally. But I guess the question then is, what is being the front runner worth then? And what kind of front runner are you? Like, to me, even pre-debates, Biden was probably an underdog relative to the field in that his polling had deteriorated a bit. It had fallen out of the 40s, you know.
Okay, so who is the front runner?
I would say Harris right now. Yeah, I would say Harris.
And that's based on?
Based on how good she looked in the debates and how good she's looked on the campaign trail. Based on what I think her campaign has been super smart. Even little things like Harris didn't actually attack Biden in the run-up to the debate that much on those segregationist comments, and then hit him in the debate really hard, which is like a really small thing, but I think shows a level of strategic thinking on the campaign's part. And then she's jumped up in the polls. Her favorability and her first choice vote support have gone up.
So we already know, Claire and Perry, that you think that Biden is still the front runner. Maybe respond to, though, the idea that if it isn't Biden, it's Harris.
The Harris one, I definitely feel like Biden has a Clinton 07 feel, a candidacy running because the person wants to be president and maybe doesn't have a clear rationale and has been told they should be president for a long time. But I think the other part that I'm struggling with a bit is it doesn't feel like, beyond the obvious, I don't necessarily see the issue matrix where Harris, like, there's, I don't know what the Iraq war equivalent for that Obama had for Harris is. I don't know if I see her as the alternative any more than like Sanders or Warren or some combination of either Pete or Booker. I still think one of these other, I'm going to come back to this phrase, a man who's not a socialist who's in this field. I think if Biden comes down, one of those people can come up, and I would say that's Pete or Booker probably.
Yeah, I don't know. So, I mean, I think probably to put words in Micah's mouth, he's thinking Harris because she's risen in the polls. She was the visible Biden attacker. She could coalition build with sort of Obama establishment people, plus maybe she could siphon off black support. Like, she could build a coalition. And that might be true. I think the historical parallels of, like, what's the Iraq war issue? And, like, is Biden like Clinton in 07? Like, maybe. And maybe all those historical parallels play out. But also maybe we're in an entirely different post-2016 paradigm and we don't know how to operate in that. I'd also say to the man stuff, you know, is Joe Biden as a white man the most electable, or will other non-socialist, not Joe Biden men become, you know, seen as the most electable people? Yeah, totally. Maybe. I would also say that there are five viable women in the race, or semi-viable women in the race, and they are all very different from each other. And perhaps as the campaign slogs on, we're 7 months into it and we have, I'm not good at math, months to go. And perhaps the American public will get more used to the different array of women and the fact that they are not Hillary Clinton, a historically disliked figure in American life. So perhaps women will become thought of as some of the women or one of the women will become thought of as electable. We don't know. I think we're operating in a really different paradigm. That's my prediction, is that perhaps historical examples don't hold on a lot of fronts.
No, that's totally fair. I should also say, by the way, that one reason I'm a little maybe more confident in Harris than I should be is because her success has not been surprising. Like in a, not to get all Nate on you guys, but in a Bayesian sense, before, like many, many months ago, I think we all said, oh, Harris has a lot of potential to build across coalitions. Harris has a lot of potential to do well in the debates. And so when both of those things then start to happen, you're justified in being a little more confident that those things are real than if, like, Swalwell all of a sudden was like surging in the polls, there'd be a bit like, well, what the f- is this?
Well, right? You know, Swalwell, who maybe by the time you're listening to this podcast
we'll
is potentially no longer running. We've heard some rumors.
Can I return this front runner question? Can I try to combine my view and Claire's view?
Go for it.
Which is to say that I think Biden's standing has deteriorated to a point. It has crossed a threshold where, given how early we are in the campaign, given how fluid primaries are, it is sort of like not helpful to discuss the campaign or to think of the campaign with Biden as a front runner. Does that make sense? Even if Biden is like technically, if we had like a perfect understanding of the way the primaries work, even if technically right now Biden has the best chance of winning, I don't think that advantage is meaningful enough or big enough where it really helps our understanding of the country or our voters or of the candidates to really view it through the lens of Biden is a front runner, is the front runner. Does that make sense? Like, I think a more helpful frame is like, okay, you have maybe a top tier, and that's how we should start talking about it, where a month ago, I think Biden was the front runner.
Do you accept that amalgamation of your views?
I'm trying to compromise here.
I accept my views, and I listen to Micah's.
And it's also, as we wrap this up, worth acknowledging that in the Democratic primary, there is a 15% threshold of support for getting delegates. So we will see how many people exceed that 15% threshold, because if a bunch of people don't, especially if some of the people within that top four, it makes even a small lead over the rest of the pack pretty significant in terms of delegate counts. But that's still a long way away, right?
Well, and even before we get there, and I think the Swalwell rumors point to this, I think we'll start to see some winnowing, you know, into the fall and before we get to Iowa. So it'll be interesting to see how that affects things too.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about Justin Amash and the state of the Never Trump movement. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs, builds, and operates workspaces for small, medium, and enterprise businesses in over 400 locations and 100 different cities around the world. WeWork and 538 have partnered to bring you The Way We Work Today, a series of articles that explores the best places to base your business in 2019. Economies and city dynamics vary from market to market, and we're taking a deep dive into which ones provide the best ecosystem for your businesses to flourish, of course, while taking into consideration any downsides to be aware of. Factors such as a city's investment in economic development, tax incentives and rates, strength of workforce, cost of living, and public infrastructure are only a few key aspects that business owners need to consider when figuring out where to base their business headquarters and satellite locations. Head over to 538.com/WeWork to learn more. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We're back, and Representative Justin Amash from Michigan was first elected in 2010 when the Tea Party swept Republicans into power in the House. He became a founding member of the Freedom Caucus, which advocated conservative orthodoxy, and sparred with more mainstream Republicans, such as even House Speaker John Boehner. But as much of the Freedom Caucus has fallen in line behind President Trump, Amash has gone his own way. He frequently criticized the president, and he was the only Republican to call for Trump's impeachment after the release of the full Mueller report. Last month, Amash left the Freedom Caucus, and last week, he left the GOP altogether. He now identifies as an independent, and he wrote in the Washington Post on July 4th, quote, "In recent years, I've become disenchanted with party politics and frightened by what I see from it. The two-party system has evolved into an existential threat to American principles and institutions." All right, a lot there. First off, Claire, what do we make of Justin Amash's reason for leaving the Republican Party? And does it say something about the broader political environment?
Well, his reasoning is almost as old as the country, right? So he cites extensively George Washington's farewell address, where he basically warns against factions. And that's a thing that I think a lot of people have argued about the American system for many years. So Justin Amash is in some ways basically the latest principled person shouting into the wind. I'm not sure it says anything about the country as a whole. I think it maybe says something about the Republican Party, actually, that Justin Amash is basically the only now former Republican who's really taken these public stands over the past few months against the Trump administration. You know, there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who used to be against Donald Trump, who now work very closely for him and are some of his greatest advocates. Lindsey Graham is a person who comes to the top of the mind on that front. So I think Justin Amash maybe says something about the Republican Party in that it has cleansed itself more and more of anti-Trump people. I think the Republican Party is not a warm place for those people. It is not a party right now that kind of welcomes constructive criticism or criticism of any kind of the president. And I think that's pretty inarguable.
No, that's totally true. The other thing I think it shows is Justin Amash, who's sort of libertarian-y. I think the libertarian strain within conservatism has sort of become more tenuous in the Trump era, where there are some interesting conversations happening where libertarianism, or the idea just that like the government should not interfere in people's lives, I think used to occupy a more central place in intellectual conservatism than it does now, where you see more people now advocating for the government to play a role, for example, in supporting Christian values, for example.
Or tariffs.
Right.
Or bailing out farmers who are affected by tariffs.
Exactly right. So I do think it shows what Claire said about there's not a strong anti-Trump wing of the party, really. There's not that much room for it. And two, the party itself, libertarianism, has sort of like been pushed out a little bit, I think.
Perry, what do you think about whether or not Amash's departure from the Republican Party says anything about the broader political environment?
I think Mike is right. I was going to mention the point about this idea. I thought the libertarian part of the Republican Party was always overemphasized in the first place. It was virtually powerless before and now totally powerless compared to the sort of white identity part of it and compared to the sort of business, pro-business part, which was not really small government, but more pro-business. So I think Amash was always sort of speaking to values the party really didn't have, except when it was opposing Obamacare. But I guess the one thing I would say is Larry Hogan announced he would not run for president last month. And I do think that was a signal for me that there isn't really, and I assume, you know, Amash probably, whatever his principled reasons, I'm pretty sure he's aware he was going to have a hard time winning his seat again if he wants that seat in Michigan. So I just think it's another sign that the Republican Party is broadly and overwhelmingly behind Trump, but there's not much room for anti-Trump Republicans.
I know this is somewhat difficult, but if we want to try to evaluate how large the group of anti-Trump or never-Trump Republicans is, both in Congress and in the electorate, how should we go about doing that? What are some points that we can look at?
So I looked up some Pew data, and what they showed is about 13% of the overall electorate is people who are Republican-leaning independents. So like Amash, basically people who are not fully Republicans but lean Republican. Of that group, about 30% of them disapprove of Donald Trump. So 30% of 13 gets you to about 4% of the electorate. So that's not a zero number. It's not a huge number. 4% could, of course, change the election if they all voted for the same person. But that's kind of what we're talking about here, is not a particularly big group. In terms of anti-Trump Republicans in Congress, I think at this point that number, with Jeff Flake gone, with Amash out of the party now, Susan Collins has gotten more pro-Trump, I think the number of really anti-Trump Republicans in Congress is a number close to zero. There's a few governors I would mention: Hogan in Maryland, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, ex-Governor John Kasich. So there's a few anti-Trump Republicans, mainly in the Northeast, but I think anti-Trump Republicanism in Congress is pretty much dead.
In an ABC News Washington Post poll back in January, about a third, I think it was something like 31% of Republicans said they would be interested in nominating somebody other than Trump in the primary. How should we view that data point as reflective of how popular Trump is within the Republican Party? I know, of course, his approval rating in the Republican Party is something like 90%.
Yeah, I think the never Trump framing, if you start there, you end up with a pretty small slice of the electorate. I think Perry's numbers seem right to me as a way just to like get a sense of how big that part of the GOP is. But I do think there's this bigger part of the GOP that is not gung-ho about Trump, uncomfortable with Trump, skeptical of Trump. A lot of those people voted for Trump in 2016.
But who'd they vote for in 2018, do you think?
Well, exactly. You know, I was looking at some Catalyst numbers, and they sort of like broke the electorate down based on how people voted historically. So they have like historical Republicans, historical middle, historical Democrats. And if you look at those numbers, what you see is, for example, the GOP typically wins up through like 2014 historical Republicans by about 75 points. That's the margin. They only won that group by 67 points in 2016 and 67 points in 2018. In other words, people who typically voted Republican didn't vote Republican by as big margins in 2016 and 2018 because of Trump, right? I think we all knew that. If you look at the historical middle, so these are like not quite independents, but some proxy for that, that group went from voting for Republicans by 1 point in 2016 to voting for Democrats by 11 points in 2018.
Wow.
So to Claire's point, I think that's the group. They don't identify as Republicans. We've talked them to death. They're maybe suburban or, you know, somewhat rural, exurban voters, maybe a little libertarian. And they've really swung to Democrats, or at least they did in 2018. I think that's a bigger share of the electorate than like the never Trump group specifically.
I mean, they might be one and the same.
Well, I think the difference is a lot of those people voted for Trump in 2016.
Yeah, okay.
They were like, oh, I don't like Hillary Clinton. I'm going to vote for Trump. But I'm kind of an independent. I'm not sure. Versus people who are longtime Republicans who were from the beginning, I'm never Trump, and voted for Gary Johnson or wrote in their best friend.
There were lots of never Trumpers during the primaries who then voted for Trump.
That's also true.
So they're not really never Trump in any meaningful way.
Yeah, but like never Trump. Well, okay.
You know what was so interesting to me is Dana Loesch, who later gained sort of notoriety as an NRA spokeswoman and NRA TV, all that stuff. She was on, you know, sort of like the Glenn Beck, what was that, the Blaze, right? And she was this big never Trumper person. And then there's a certain contingent of people. I think she probably made the decision for business reasons, for lack of a better phrase. But people who are kind of like, oh, psych, Trump, 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 Trump. And that's a different iteration of it. But there could be people who aren't Dana Loesch and aren't in the radio business who would say, like, I was a never Trumper. I voted for him eventually, but now I'm kind of back to like, yikes, I don't like this guy.
Yeah. But I guess I just think there are limited gains for Democrats within the never Trump framing. For one, as Perry said, it's small. But two, to go back to those catalyst numbers, Democrats made gains with that group, with the historical Republican group in 2016. So I think you saw there that that kind of never Trump manifests itself, where there was this group of voters who historically voted for Republicans who did not vote for Trump. Now, the flip side of that is there was this group of historical Democrats who voted for Trump, right? But then in 2018, Democrats didn't make further gains with that historical Republican group. Does that make sense?
But they did probably win back some historical Democrats, right?
Exactly. Their margin increased with historical Democrats, not quite back to where it was pre-Trump, but sort of close. They didn't make any more gains with the historical Republican group, but they made huge gains with the historical middle group.
So that gives us a sense of the electorate. Perry, you said that in Congress, it would seem as though the anti-Trump part of the Republican Party is down to about zero. In doing interviews after publishing this op-ed, Amash has said, you know, people have been texting me, calling me, telling me that they're glad I'm doing what I'm doing, you know, from within his former caucus, not the Freedom Caucus, but the Republican caucus. What do you make of that? Are they there but just not talking? What is the dynamic that's going on? Or is he just making that up?
Is it possible Mitt Romney, someone who's been pretty critical of Trump at times, text messaged Amash to say, I agree with you standing for constitutionalism? Sure. I mean, are there like four or five members who might have done that? Sure. I don't mean to be rude, but what is the point of people telling you things in private? What does that tell us? Like, if politicians won't say things in public, that's how they get their views out. If the whole anti-Trump movement in Congress is silent in public, but texting Justin Amash, I don't know what that tells me. I mean, I guess he's saying there's a silent minority or a silent big group. I don't.
Perry, are you saying that politicians might be hypocritical?
I'm saying that his claim is purposeless. As long as they don't say anything in public, it doesn't matter. As long as they're voting with Trump and largely defending him in public, then it doesn't really matter what they say in private, is what I might be getting at.
Because the conventional wisdom is that a healthy minority, maybe even a majority of elected Republicans are not personally fond of Trump, right?
Many of his ex-cabinet members seem to have called him moron in some form or another.
So that's not new, right, Perry? Like, that's kind of been reported before.
Exactly. We know that people in Washington do not have a great amount of respect in private. They don't think Trump is smart. They don't think he's qualified to be president. They think he's erratic. Some of them think he's racist in private. But
he controls...
Yes.
A substantial block of Republican voters.
Who they are, who these members are deathly afraid of.
Exactly.
I think someone should come out with those private
They
comments.
Do all the time, right?
Not no, with names attached.
You know, I was reading this will all go unnamed, but I was reading a profile of a politician in a major magazine on the plane this weekend, and there were a bunch of anonymous quotes, and I knew who the quote was from, probably. And it wasn't an inflammatory quote, but people in politics are just so lily-livered about putting stuff on the record, let alone incredibly inflammatory things. It is wildly frustrating. So I don't think anyone should expect that this stuff ever really comes out, except in, you know, 4th of July-themed op-eds as someone leaves the party and sets the
And even
bushes
then,
on
they
fire.
Don't come out.
I think the question I'm sort of more curious about, so you're Justin Amash, you've renounced all parties and all parties are stupid, or you're Brett Stevens and you've said the Democrats are too left and what can you do? These people are not going to win the Republican primary with William Weld. But if the sort of never Trump group got into the Democratic primary and decided to help Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar, both in terms of giving money, writing up, it's like, imagine if Brett Stevens, instead of like, Kamala made me racially insecure today, said Joe Biden is the best candidate and here's why. I think that would actually be more interesting use of his power and influence.
There's a lot of ex John Kasich and George Bush staffers who seem to be talking up Joe Biden and the moderates. I mean, there are some never Trumper people or former staffers of never Trumper people who seem to be voluble in their support for someone like Joe Biden, saying this is the person who can win, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Part of the story coming out of the 2018 midterms was that Democrats made a lot of gains in these traditionally Republican areas like Orange County, Georgia's 6th, wealthy Houston suburbs, etc. If those right-leaning independents or never-Trump Republicans were to vote in the Democratic primary, first of all, do we think they would consider voting in the Democratic primary? If they did, would they have any kind of meaningful impact? Are they having any kind of meaningful impact, Perry?
I would love to see a good data point on this. We know that Joe Biden is winning, quote-unquote, moderates and conservatives in the primary, but a lot of black voters identify themselves as moderates, but those people are, but African-American voters are probably not ex-Republicans. So I don't know. I think I'd like to know, if somebody wants to do a poll, you know, people who identified as Republican in 2014 backward, who are now moved away from the Republican Party because of Trump, where are they? Who are they for? And are they giving money and actually going to get involved in the Democratic primary? I guess what I'm more saying is, if a Justin Amash wants to have, or people like that want to have any actual impact on our political process, the smart thing to do would be to get involved in the primary where, because the Democratic primary is a fight between moderates and liberals, and those groups are basically balanced equally, while in the Republican primary, Trump versus anti-Trump is like a 90-10 fight.
I think they would have to come over like wholesale to have a real influence. I mean, I haven't looked at this systematically, but like, I don't think the share of Democrats identifying as moderate or conservative has inched up, really, which is what you would expect, I think, if this was happening in a meaningful way.
That would mean in the span of like 4 years, they're leaving the Republican Party, then identifying as Democrats, right? Like, isn't it potentially a more slow process than them?
More Americans are identifying as independent than ever before, and that increases. So that's probably, I think that is the transition demarcation
like
for people. That's the transition identity.
Yeah, I guess I'm just skeptical that the Brett Stevenses of the world are going to decide the Democratic primary. I don't think there are enough of them. Perry has written about this. The Democratic Party is not as liberal as a lot of people sort of describe it. There are a lot of moderates and even conservatives in the Democratic Party. But many of those voters, one, are black. And I don't think those voters are really represented by the kind of Bret Stevenses of the world.
Why has Bret Stevens become our
president? I don't know. Anyway, so you have black voters, many of whom identify as moderate or conservative. Then you have non-college educated white voters who have been trending Republican, but many of whom are still in the Democratic Party. You know, are they really represented by Jennifer Rubins of the world and the Bret Stevens of the world? Not really. I don't think that's kind of where there's an opportunity for influence.
All right. Well, of course, we'll see. If anybody heeds Perry's request to do a poll, maybe we'll find out. To wrap up here, another route is just, as Amash is doing, kind of ignoring the two parties altogether. It seems like he'll run as an independent for his seat in Congress in 2020. He also hasn't ruled out running for the presidency. If somebody like Justin Amash were to run for president in 2020 as an independent or a third party such as Libertarian, how would that affect the race, Claire?
I don't think it would affect it meaningfully. You mean in the general election?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I already think Bill Weld is in there as the sort of protest vote. What if Justin Amash and Bill Weld ran together? Now, there's an odd couple. Like, how much did Evan McMullen disrupt the presidential election in any real way? Even Gary Johnson, for that matter. I just don't think it's that big of an impact. It's not the... Now, maybe I'm underselling Justin Amash's talents. Maybe he would be a Ross Perot-esque figure, and I am completely wrong. But...
I'll believe it when I see it. The two-party system is so entrenched that I think the right approach is I'll believe it when I'll see it.
Oh, I think they would be really problematic for the Democrats if someone like Amash ran. In the same way that I think Jill Stein and Gary Johnson were a problem for Hillary, is that there's an anti-Trump majority in the country and was in 2016, but where those people go is an issue. And now that you have Amash who's saying, I hate both parties, but Trump should be impeached and he's terrible, kind of mirrors 4% of the electorate, I suspect. So I do, and people who I would think would be more inclined to vote for Joe Biden than Donald Trump otherwise. So I do, if you're talking about a very close race in Wisconsin, I do think someone like Amash is somebody, my guess is you'll see Democrats saying, please do not run Justin Amash.
No, that's probably true in like a really close election. But I guess I would expect in 2020 there to be more strategic voting than there was in 2016. I don't think a lot of people thought Trump really had a chance in 2016, where a lot of those never Trumpers would not vote for the Evan McMullens of the world.
All right. Well, I think we will leave it there. A lot of things we're just going to have to wait and see how they pan out. But I guess that's the fun of covering an election. For now, Claire, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.